You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Episode 41 of That One Time on Tour is brought to you by the band Wanted Noise. The members of Wanted Noise grew up in San Diego, Maui, and Goleta, California during the 90s and 2000s. As kids, they found punk rock through the soundtracks of skate and surf clips. They're currently crafting their debut album Next Generation, which is influenced by Fat Records bands like Lagwagon, NoFX, and Face to Face. For more information on the band, you can check them out on Instagram and Facebook at Wanted Noise CA. At their Bandcamp, wantednoise.bandcamp.com. Their music is also available on iTunes, YouTube, and Spotify. Now here it is, their new single, Two Steps.
Two steps forward, one step back. I'm on my own track. Two steps forward, one step back. I'm still moving forward. Two steps forward, one step back. At least I'm still on track. Two steps forward, one step back. I'm still fucking moving forward. On this couch I sit like a rock in a stream. Time flows by, I chill and I dream. People say words, I know what they mean, but I don't care at all, I just want to scream. Stuck like a mouse in a trap. It just sucked me in, and now I can't go back. It looked so cozy, I just wanted to relax. But now I'm on a cloud, drinking nothing back. You might think I'm doing nothing, but I know I'm on to something. On this session, it's disgusting. So it's only me I'm trusting. You might think I'm doing nothing, but I know I'm on to something. On this session, it's disgusting. So it's only me I'm trusting. Step forward, one step back. I'm on my own track. Step forward, one step back. I'm still moving forward. I'm on my own track. Two steps forward, one step back.
I'm still moving forward.
Two steps forward, one step back. At least I'm still on track. Two steps forward, one step back. I'm still fucking moving forward.
You're gonna get right.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series
about how they died, why they died, and while we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.
Sean Cologne from Open Ended Films, and you're listening to That One Time on Tour.
Run for the road, 'cause it's going on and on. We'll be driving through the darkest night until the break of dawn. We'll be heading for the cities, another show for us to play. To get back in the bank tomorrow, we'll do it, we'll do it.
Hey, what's going on? This is Chris Swinney. I am your host for That One Time on Tour. This is my podcast where I get to sit down with someone in or around the music industry, and we have a kick-ass conversation. So thanks a lot for checking out last week's episode. Hopefully you did. If not, you can go back and check it out after this episode. This week, I got to sit down with Mr. Sean Cologne from Open Ended Films. Sean was the director of an awesome documentary on my favorite record label, Fat Records. It's called A Fat Rec, and it tells the story of the record label, how Fat Mike from NOFX started it with his ex-wife Erin. And it's a great story. I think people that I know that have watched it that weren't even fans of the bands or the label really loved it. It's a great story, and we get into the whole thing with Sean. We also talk about our love of podcasts and all kinds of crazy stuff. So before I get into this week's episode, I do need to take care of some business like I do all the time. I've got some amazing sponsors that I need to tell you guys about. Back once again, rockabilia.com. They are your one-stop shop for everything from your favorite band. They're just amazing. You got to go check them out, man. They have over 500,000 unique items officially licensed by the bands. So head on over to rockabilia.com and at checkout, put in the promo code PCTOTOT, and you're going to save 15% on your entire order. I'm saving you money. Go on over there and check it out. I also need to tell you guys about Sticker Wolf. I love Sticker Wolf. They did our logo. They've sent me some amazing stickers for the show that I'm giving out to our patrons. I'll tell you about Patreon here in a little bit. So go on over to Sticker Wolf. They do graphic design work. They do amazing stickers, buttons, all kinds of stuff. And hit them up at stickerwolf.com or on all of the social media platforms at Sticker Wolf. You can also tell them, I don't know if it's a put in or if you just tell them, but they said the code TOTOT will get you 10% off. So check that out. I also need to tell you about Muncie Music Center.com. It's MuncieMusic.com, but the store is Muncie Music Center. I teach guitar there, basically anything with strings. It's a really cool little mom and pop music store here in Muncie, Indiana. They've got everything that you need if you're a musician, and you guys need to check them out and support them. They're at 600 South Mulberry Street in Muncie, or you can check them out online, like I said, at MuncieMusic.com. So I talked about Patreon, so I need to tell you guys about it. We actually have a new patron. We are up to 3 patrons now. That's amazing, man. If you guys are interested in becoming a patron, go on over to patreon.com/TOTOT podcast. I just put up an episode where someone interviewed me, like a bonus episode, and I'm putting up all kinds of cool stuff over there, and I'm planning on doing some cool exclusive content for our patrons. So go on over to patreon.com/TOTOT podcast. If you think that this is a cool podcast, you like what I'm doing, you think it's worth something, help me out. If not, I totally understand. Listen for free. I want you guys here anyway. But I do need to give a shout out to Aaron Schultz. He is our new patron, and he is out of Indiana. So thank you very much, Aaron, for pledging your $5 a month pledge It really helps us keep the lights on. There, you know, there's some costs associated with the podcast, and I do appreciate it. So big ups to Aaron Schultz out of Indiana. Thank you very, very much. That's all the business. I do want to tell you, you know, a little bit about my life. This week's been tough, man. My car broke down a few days back, and I wasn't sure what was going on. It was out of coolant, so, you know, I put some more coolant in it. 5 seconds later, the coolant is on the ground. So I limp it up to the service station. They tell me I've got to take it to a Ford dealership. The Ford dealership tells me it's going to be $1,200. Then they check it out, and they find out that, oh, it's going to be $4,500 because they have to put a new engine in because coolant got into the engine. And if any of you guys out there know, when coolant gets into your engine and mixes with your oil, that's bad news. So I didn't know what I was going to do, and then my wife found this cool SUV on Facebook Marketplace, and I went and checked it out, and it was the right price, and I got it. So I am mobile again. No more Uber for me for a while. But so we've got a Mercury Mariner. Maybe if I say that enough, maybe they'll send me like a new Mercury Mariner. Probably not. You got to be like Joe Rogan or somebody to get that. But that's what's going on in my life. Kids are great. Wife's great. Tomorrow is Valentine's Day, so I do want to give a shout out to my wife. I hope she will listen to this. She might listen to this. Felicia Michelle Swinney, I love you. You are my personal and thanks for everything you do, and thanks for being my executive producer and giving me the time to do this podcast. So everybody out there in podcast land, you should, on Instagram, Facebook, whatever, comment and thank my wife and tell her happy Valentine's Day. She's an amazing person, and she deserves the support. Okay, that's enough. I'm rambling. You guys are sick of hearing about it. You came to hear Sean talk about Fat Records and his life, so that's what we're going to do. So make sure that you're following us on all of the social media platforms. It's at TOTOT Podcast. If you want to become a sponsor, you heard Wanted Noise at the beginning. They're a really cool band out of California. They sponsored this episode, and your band or company can as well. Just hit me up, TOTOTpodcast@gmail.com. Call the hotline, leave me some love, some hate, 1-765-372-8818. I've got some cool messages people have left me that I'm going to start playing. And I don't know if you heard last week's episode with Brandon from Rancid, but at the end of the episode, there was this little snippet of my son saying that he had to poo-poo. I thought it was hilarious. I loved in the 90s and like early 2000s, you'd buy like an album and there was always a hidden track. You know, I don't know if you guys know what I mean, but like you'd wait like 10 minutes past the last song and there'd be like a hidden track. So I'm going to try to do some funny stuff here and there. I'm going to do like a hidden track at the end of the podcast. So maybe it'll make you listen to the whole podcast so you can know what the hidden track's going to be. We'll see how that goes. I'm just trying to make things a little bit more entertaining. Yeah, that's it, man. Subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes or wherever you consume your podcast. It really helps out, and it helps the visibility of the podcast. So thank you very much if you've done so. If you haven't, you got to get to it. Just click that little button. And my dog just came in the studio. How you doing, Lucy? She heard me talking. She was asleep. I don't know if she's going to be on the podcast or not, but here she is. Her name's Lucy. She's a bulldog. She's awesome. She's getting up on my lap. Okay, so I got to get off here or Lucy's going to be my co-host. So I love you guys. And I'll be back at the end of the conversation to do the outro. I'm going to play a couple songs. So stick around for that and the hidden track at the end. But here's my conversation with Sean Colone. It's a long one. Here we go. And I'm on the line with Mr. Sean Colone. How are you doing today, Sean?
I'm good, man. Really good.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Dude, thanks for having me on the show. Like, I'm a big podcast fan, so it's always cool when I get to be on one.
Yeah, I was on one yesterday. It's weird. It was the guy was a big Atari's fan, and he also likes my show, so he wanted me to be on his show. And it's always odd from being like the host guy to then going to that, you know?
Right, exactly. It's for me, I do a lot of interviewing, obviously, for documentaries. So I'm usually the one sitting there listening.
Yeah, totally.
But I love to talk, so I love being on the talking side.
Well, we're going to do a lot of talking today. It's going to be a lot of fun. So, okay, so the first thing that I want to know, I mean, we'll get into all of the stuff that you've done and your documentary and everything, but I want to know, first of all, how old are you?
38.
Okay, so you're 2 years younger than me, so we're right there in that same kind of, you know, generation of Fat Records and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I want to know what kind of got you into not only music, but like the punk genre. Like, what was it for you when you were young and you were starting out?
Yeah, you know, I grew up in Savannah, Georgia, and there wasn't a lot of, like stuff that when I was like 12 or 13, I was just, it's all mainstream stuff. And obviously, because there. But there were some high school girls, I think when I was like in like eighth grade, that, you know, like opened me up to some, like they had punk, Punk-O-Rama.
Yeah, yeah.
Punk-O-Rama. I think the first like time I ever heard NOFX was on Punk-O-Rama. But it was like, it wasn't just punk. And it, that didn't actually pull me in at that point. I just had heard, that's the first time I heard NOFX. You know, I think it's like, you know, the Don't Call Me White.
Yeah, yeah.
So progressive, right?
Yeah, totally. Like
back then, you know. but what really made me go and get the NOFX Punk and Drublic was my sister lived in California, in the Los Angeles area. And I would sometimes go out and stay with her for the summers, like for 2 or 3 months. But she didn't have a lot of money, so she would go to work, and I was just going to be like left to my own devices. And to get around, I'd walk. But at the time, she had these rollerblades, and they were like purple. It's just awful. I could get, my range was much farther because I had walked everywhere I could. You know, first few days I'm there, and I'm like, I want to go out farther. So I ended up running into these skater kids, and I thought I was hanging out with these guys, and they were being cool, and they were like, so, you know, what bands do you like? You ever heard of NOFX? I was like, NOFX? And I didn't connect two and two that I'd heard it before, you know?
Yeah.
But they were like, you haven't heard of NOFX? And they were like, well, they ended up robbing me.
You were on rollerblades, correct?
Right. They were like, I know. I know. Yeah, like I was from Savannah. I didn't know anything, man. I had long hair, Nirvana hair. But they took like my Game Boy. I mean, not like from me. They're like, hey, we're gonna go. We gotta go to her house. I'm like, oh, okay, see you guys. And then when I went to my bag, my stuff was gone. But they took a lot of CDs, which is weird because they were making fun of me for the music. So weird. but then when I got back, I went and found NOFX.
Yeah.
And found that I really liked it. So.
were you already into like some of the mainstream stuff at the time? Like, was this around the time of like the punk explosion with Green Day and Offspring and stuff like that?
It was a little earlier. I my introduction to anything punk was through Nirvana.
Okay.
Like the even the interest in the word punk came from like being a big Nirvana head and reading the books and doing all that shit. And you'd hear like the bands that they would talk about and how all their music came from the punk scene and, you know, that there are variation on that and things like that. So, you know, when someone's like, oh, this, you know, punk and Drublic, you know, like that word punk, I didn't associate it necessarily with, like, I don't know, I wasn't like, I didn't know the Ramones and all that stuff at the time. So, my introduction was, I like the technical stuff because I used to be in like Sepultura.
That's why the Fat Wreck stuff kind of stood out for me because, you know, coming from a total metal background, like I love like Metallica, I loved Iron Maiden. So when I heard the Fat Wreck stuff, I'm like, wow, this is not metal, but it had such a metal edge to it. And I think, I mean, partially in your documentary, they talk a lot about that. And that's what drew you in as well.
Yeah. I mean, I was a big Sepultura guy. And it was what I liked a lot about Sepultura was that it was very technical, but they did a lot of like, I didn't know it at the time, but they have a lot of punk influences in some of the way they do drums, like the double time and you know, that kind of stuff. And they even had some songs that were straight up like punk songs, you know, on like some Sepultura stuff. But the other thing that drew me into Sepultura was that Max Cavalera was always talking about socio-political type things.
Yeah.
You know, like stuff going on in Brazil and like the indigenous, what happened to the indigenous people. And the lyrics would be like kind of dark, but it'd be like, I don't know. It was also like very like, I don't know. It had a consciousness and it was deeper than most metal, which is like the darkness inside me is growing. You know, just like,
yeah.
I couldn't get into that kind of stuff, but I always got into the stuff that like the technical music. And then I remember the first time someone showed me Strung Out, and I had heard like other punk bands, and I think it was on a mixtape. Somebody had made me a tape of a bunch of Fat Records bands, and when I heard them do a pitch harmonic, like in a song, you know, like that
I
was like, what? You could do this in punk rock? I was like, what? So I was like, it had like I wanted to dive in more, and then from that I just, you know. Yeah, Propagandi and Good Riddance, and just really, really kind of was drawn to those bands.
Were you playing guitar at the time, or like, were you into like that side of it, or were you just more of like a fan?
No, I was playing. Yeah, I was playing guitar too. I mean, I was in a punk band in my sophomore year of high school. So it was like 2 years after I heard, like within the time of hearing NoFX, I was like, I had already wanted to be in a band. I had been playing guitar and playing Nirvana stuff and, you know, and I like that kind of thing. But once I had heard that kind of music, like I, like there was another punk band in like the high school I went to, and I ended up being friends with those guys. We've now been friends for 25 plus years and have like our kids hang out and shit now.
Wow.
And we're still in bands together. Like, you know what I mean? Like we'd have a recording studio together. We did the whole thing, but it was like, that's the kind of music we wanted to play. And even in high school, we were playing, you know, like, I was too cool for school. And I mean that in the most sarcastic way.
Yeah, I gotcha.
We thought we were cool, but we were like, I didn't really do much in high school because I thought high school was lame. So we were like, we were playing like shows in like, you know, pizza shops and like some bars, some types of bars and stuff when we were in high school. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of people that were doing that. And my buddies had mohawks and they got in trouble, get written up in the school paper because of like, I wasn't that cool though. I didn't have a mohawk, but although I will say this, here's something that's really interesting that kind of ties everything with the Fat Records documentary together. My senior year, I took media tech.
Okay.
And you know, very basic stuff. But some of my buddies, they were shooting this documentary called "Fuck the World" about the punk scene in Denton. And for part of the documentary, I had long, like Nirvana hair, and in the thing they cut my hair into a mohawk.
Wow.
One of these punk rock guys cut my hair, and then we interviewed what's his face from the Queers,
Joe.
Yeah, it was the craziest thing. I'd never seen anything like that. Was the first punk rock show I ever went to was the Queers, and he came off stage and hung out with everybody, and like that just was completely. I'd never seen that before. Everything I understood music to be is like those people do that over there. You know, the big people, big bands are like, they're over there and you're over here. And that was like, I don't know, that was another thing about the scene that drew me in beyond the music. That's what drew me more into the scene, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I remember the first time I went to his show and there wasn't a barricade. And I was like, what happens if like people go crazy? it was insane, like, because I was used to going to, you know, big arena shows and stuff when I was young.
Yeah.
I remember the first actual punk show that I went to was just a bunch of local bands, and they were all a lot older than me. And I the whole time, you know, going to the show, I'm like, oh, we're gonna go to the show, it's gonna in this little tiny place, but it's gonna be like a concert. And you walk in and there's not even a stage, and it kind of it doesn't compute with you at first, but then once you see it and you see how great it is, you never want to go to an arena show again.
Right. Oh man, I can't do arena shows. I mean, to be honest with you, it's hard for me to do shows at all.
man, after all the touring I've done, it's got to be somebody that I can't, you know, live without seeing. Like, my buddy's like, you gonna go to the Descendants show a couple months back? And I'm like, well, if Stefan will be on the podcast, I'll go to the Descendants show. And then he was, so I went to the show.
Great. He's so rad. He's a rad dude, man.
Yeah, Stefan's great. Shout out to Stefan and all the guys from the Descendants. They're super great. They've always been super great to me. But yeah, I just, man, there's so many shows that come up and I get excited and I'm like, man, I don't want to do that.
I just not like, the only time I ever go to shows is if our band is playing a show.
Yeah.
And it just sounds bad. It's like, I think I can watch Wilhelm Scream.
Oh yeah. Sure. Oh yeah.
I can watch Propagandi anytime for the rest of my life.
Dude, Propagandi, like, that's one thing I wanted to talk to you about, because the thing that, like, the research I've done on you and I've read some other interviews and, you know, just watching the documentary, I know that you and I both have this like thing for Propagandi. They are one of the first bands that kind of showed me what punk could be.
They show me beyond punk, man. To me, like, it helped develop my worldview, and I don't agree with everything they agree with, but it made me start looking into those things. I mean, they were talking about the Gaza Strip back in 94.
Oh, yeah.
And just hearing Gaza Strip and, like, reading, trying to find out about it, or asking my dad, like, what's this Gaza Strip, and what is, you know, and it just, it opened my mind to the world and understanding, even like they were so progressive back then, that so much stuff that's happening right now, I have such a context for because I read and like, you know, all the references, and it would make me go look up words in the dictionary. I'm like, what does that mean? It improved my vocabulary. It improved my my place in the world, in the sense of like, you know, researching and being, not being ignorant of other people's plights.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. You know, and if you're like someone who cares about other people at all, like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. There's something about propaganda. Like, you meet other people who like propaganda, and it's this common thing that there's a certain ethics, there's a certain ethos, I'd say, that most people who like propaganda are going to have.
Yeah, definitely.
If you didn't, you would not listen to them. You know, like.
Yeah, I mean, I remember you were talking about, you know, they said Gaza Strip back in the day in that song. That song, there's that one part where they just chant fuck religion for like a minute.
Right.
And I remember when I was younger, like in high school, you know, my parents like trying to get me not to listen to gangster rap or taking different CDs away. And I remember my mom walked into my room one time right when he started yelling fuck religion. And my mom's like, what is this? And they didn't take it away from me, but it was kind of a weird time, because they were thinking, oh, all this like gangster rap stuff is the bad stuff. I'm like, well, this isn't bad. Maybe you don't like what he's saying, but it actually means something, you know?
Right. Well, even that, like that song, like it's misleading in a way, because you hear Gaza Strip and you hear like fuck religion, but then you start like I dove more into that, and it's not necessarily about the Palestinian stuff. It's about this like form of what is it called? Rastafari, which is like this bastardification of like, which like, as you start to like, you're thinking like, oh, this is about the Palestinian conflict, but like, oh no, it's this other, has all these other layers. And it also made me appreciate like a depth in lyrics, and made me like set the bar at a certain level. I mean, kind of why I kind of fell out with Strung Out, you know, that pitch harmonic brought me in, right? But then as I dove into a lot of their lyrics once Jim died, just not my cup of tea. It's too it's flowery language and little too on the poetic side.
Yeah, I gotcha.
You know, like those guys have been super nice to me, so I would never say anything. But like, just lyrically, like I need something that's like
more thought provoking, maybe.
You know, and as I say this, it's interesting. One of my favorite propaganda songs is like Without Love.
Yeah.
And like that's, I think one of the best things that happened to propaganda is when they started turning inward, you know what I mean? And kind of like
there was a definite shift in like the songwriting, not musically really. I mean, I guess there wasn't in the music as well, but in the lyrics, as you know, the guys in the band got older and maybe had kids or whatever. I mean, it changed quite a bit. And I like the new direction that they're in now.
I mean, if you're as much a fan as I am, like you'll like hear lines that Chris has like rewritten and put in a much more sophisticated way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like where it was super blunt before, which is what I liked at that age. I love that, how blunt it was. You know, you could stick this fucking flag up your ass, you know?
Yeah.
And then you find out they're from Canada and you're like, what?
Yeah, totally.
But it's like, I've heard lines that I know are the exact same line rewritten so he can say it in a way that's, gets the point across, but doesn't have that same, like, doesn't put someone on the defensive, you know?
Yeah.
You know, he had a line about cheering on embassy bombings, you know, which I was like, you know, but like, I see what he's saying. He's like, I've been reduced to, you know, I'm like nothing more than, but then later, I think it's in Potemkin. He uses that same line, but written in a much more nuanced way, but it's the same concept, you know what I mean?
And I feel like if you're so, you know, they were so young, they've been around for so long, some of those first records, some of the stuff they were saying, you said it was very blunt, you know, as you get older, it would really suck to be kind of taken on what you wrote when you were like 18, 19 years old. So
I think what they were saying was great.
It's just now they're saying it in a better way, a more kind of, I don't know, it gets the point across better without being so blunt. I get what you're saying.
Well, I mean, he, like early on, they had such a self-awareness in the lyrics. You know, how he says, like, of course I recognize the irony. you know, the system that affords me the luxury, you know, of biting the hand that feeds. That's exactly why privileged fucks like me should feel obliged to whine and kick and scream. Like, I mean, that's fucking, that is so well written. Like, that is just, I said that to somebody, like, without telling them that. I kind of, like, afterwards I said it was from a song, but when I said that to them, like, it was a person, like, that doesn't know punk rock or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I said that to them because we were talking about, like, you know, why you should be pushing for everyone to have, you know, rights. And I said that line, and they, like, I had, like, completely impressed them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, like, and I was like, by the way, that's from a song of this band that I like, you know, like, I had to, like, I wouldn't take credit for it, you know, but I mean, I think it became more nuanced, but I think it was always pretty sophisticated, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely, man.
So, I mean, and I was going to say, like, as a side note, it's insane for me, like, to know those guys and know them where they know me and, like, I consider them friends, you know what I mean?
I have a crazy story about that. Do you know how, you know, back in the day, the early Propagandhi stuff, even up through now, with the internet being around, it's easier to know what they all look like. But back on their first few records, you know, you didn't really know what they looked like. They were from
right.
Canada, and if you didn't see them live, you had no idea. And I remember back in maybe the early 2000s, I'm not sure what year it was. I've always been a big Propagandhi fan, but I never really knew what they looked like. And I didn't see them live until probably 8 years ago, you know?
So, wow. Holy
yeah,
shit.
It just, they never came around here. And when they did come close, I was on tour and it was just kind of weird.
Right, right.
So basically the story, I think you'll love the story that we can get back to the little timeline we've got going. But I was on tour with this band called The Reason up in Canada. They're on Warner Brothers. And we were playing at this little tiny bar in Winnipeg. And we got done playing, and I'd been talking to the guys all day, like, this is where Propagandhi's from. Like, I was so excited. And we got done playing the gig, and the bar was open till, like, super late, like 4 or 5 in the morning. So after the gig, we loaded out, and then we're just kind of drinking beer, like, hanging out at the bar. And there's this guy at the bar, and he walks over, and he says, hey, can I join you? And I was like, yeah, man, sure. And he sat down. I said, you from Winnipeg? He's like, yeah. And we just started talking, and, like, I bought him a beer, and like then he bought me a drink, and like all this stuff, and we just kept talking. He said, "What kind of music are you into?" And I said, "Well, I love punk rock. You know, I'm in this band. We're playing." And I said, "You know, we're in Winnipeg. One of my favorite bands is from Winnipeg." He's like, "Well, what's one of your favorite bands?" And I said, "Propagandhi." And he goes, "Yeah, I sing in that band." I had no idea it was Chris. And then after that, we talked for like another 2 hours, and it was great. But like I had no idea. And I think he thought I was maybe fucking with him or something. I don't know. But, you know, living in Indiana my whole life, where once in a while we would get some kind of punk band or some band that I liked, or we'd have to go to Chicago or Cincinnati or Louisville and then start touring, you know, full time when you get out of high school or whatever. And you just, there's certain bands that you loved, but if they didn't put their pictures in the CD, you had no idea what they looked like. And that was kind of what happened. And if I ever see him again, I want to talk to him about it and make sure he knows I wasn't fucking with him.
It's so true. Like, now you know what everyone looks like. Cause like, you ever heard of the ska band Mephiscopheles?
Oh yeah.
Cause I just started following them on Facebook cause they're putting out a new record. And I was showing my daughter, she's 4. I showed her Mephiscopheles.
Get them started like, young, man.
She loves Doomsday. Like she even does the laugh.
Yeah.
Like, but, I didn't know their lead singer was a black dude.
Oh, I didn't know that to this day. Yeah. I had no idea.
I had no idea. And they're like, they've been like active again and they're going to put out a new record. And like, cause they did a tour and my buddies went like to the show and I wish I would have gone because I really like they're one of my favorite ska bands I would say.
Yeah.
And like I was like, this is crazy. I was like, that's so awesome. Like I mean it's awesome that I had no idea. You know what I mean? It's one of those bands that I had no idea. Because they didn't have pictures of them in the album's artwork, you know, or in the albums when I had it. So like you said, man, it's like back then, I think that's totally legitimate.
Yeah, I mean, and that I totally think, now that I think back, and you know, I'm trying to remember exactly what happened, I think that he thought I was messing with him a little bit, but when I found out, because at first I didn't even really believe him, and then we started talking about Fat Records and all kinds of stuff, and I was like, oh my gosh, like, you're honestly Chris Hanna, that's insane. And yeah, it was a really good tour memory to have that I was freaked out because I didn't know what he looked like.
Right, man. That's awesome, dude. Yeah, propaganda. That's shit.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll come back to some of that. But let's. So you're playing in bands. You know, you're into punk rock now. You're getting pretty deep into it. When did film kind of become a thing for you?
That was like 5 years ago.
Okay.
Now, when I was doing that, my friends were doing the documentary. I shot a little bit of it, but it was more. I wanted to be an audio engineer. It was
okay.
My goal at the time. Which I did. I mean, me and my buddies, we started a studio. We've had a studio now for 15 years in Dallas. And we recorded with Joey Cape, recorded a little song with Joey Cape when he came through. That's kind of how it was one of the kind of like first little connections that I had. This is like, it was years before the Fat Doc though.
Yeah.
But the film thing, like we had, me and my buddy, like my hetero life mate, the guy I was telling you about, I've been friends with since 25, you know, for 25 years.
Yeah.
Like we'd play in bands and we played Fest. Finally got on Fest.
Okay.
And I mean, I'm sure you know Fest, right?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
I mean, you know how it's like the drinking is excessive.
It's
you know
what I mean? Very excessive, yeah.
There's free beer sometimes, you know, yeah. Like there's been years of free beer, free Pats. And my buddy, he had a drinking problem, you know what I mean? He was not, that's what the guy is a super responsible dude, almost every other aspect of his life, you know what I mean? But drinking was his Achilles heel. And things came to a head at Fest, and like suffice to say, like we came there in one van and we left in an airplane, a car, and the van had to be, I think, returned back to it was a mess. Just like, I won't go into all the detail, but it was a mess. And, you know, the next morning I found I got a call from my buddy's cell phone, but it wasn't him. It was a guy who had found him. And, it was, you know, he's like, hey, your friend, I think, needs help. So I went and I found him and I told him, like, hey, no, nothing you could do would, like, change how I, like, our friendship. Like, I love you like a brother. But our relationship professionally is going to have to change until you figure out what's going on. Like we had a studio together, we had the band together and all that kind of stuff. And so our band broke up and basically I thought the studio was done. And, you know, I was like, you know, that was about 10 years of my life right there. Also, you know, worried about my buddy. And at the time I was the marketing director for this talent development school. And I had the opportunity to start, you know, there was all these kids that needed music videos and they didn't know it was good or whatever. So I developed a music video program at the place I was at. And I just decided that I was going to just go into film and start doing film stuff because I had always wanted to do, I kind of knew that I wanted to do film eventually. But like at the time it was like, I got to do music and be an audio engineer and do that and kind of do it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And really try and do it. Like I ran live audio. I recorded a bunch of albums and, you know, shit like for local people and other, you know, we started a punk rock record label called Dang Records, that we has, you know, we had about 12 or 15 bands that we were helping out bands, not like a full on label. We would just help bands either with like little bits of money for finishing things off or help them with promotions and all that kind of stuff. But after all that was kind of, I was like, I'm gonna do film. And because where I was at the place, I produced two small music videos, and then we got like a $20,000 budget music video.
Wow.
And like, I got a taste of what like crafty and having like, it was a location shoot. We had rented places for everyone to stay. It was a crew of 30 people. We shot on Reds and had like it was like I had catered food, custom pies. Like, it was like the crazy, like I should, we pulled it off. It was great. Like it was
awesome.
But these are families that had a lot of money, like,
yeah.
You know, clearly. But when it came to the shooting, and this is, I'm kind of getting you to where I started the Fat Wreck Doc.
Okay.
We shot, because we had, I guess I did a pretty good job producing it, I had gotten everyone who needed to do their job. So when we were there, I really didn't have much to do. All my job was ahead of time, you know. So me and my shooting partner, and like he's also a drummer in our band, and I've known him for 12 years. He like he's actually the person that kind of pulled me into film more than anything. Since we didn't have anything to do, we were like, let's shoot a behind-the-scenes thing for this. And it was the first thing that I had ever edited and shot intentionally like that. And when it came together so well that they were like, hey, we want to screen this before the video. And they rented out a theater to screen the video. And so they showed this little making-of documentary, and people laughed, and we wanted them to laugh, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, it was the most interesting experience, especially being a musician. It was like being a musician, but like watching yourself. You know, when you're on stage, you can never watch yourself perform live. You can see a video of it, but it's not the same as being there and watching yourself. So when you're watching a movie play that you made, and it does the things that you want it to do, it's just like, it's a crazy feeling.
Dude, I know the feeling because like I started this podcast because I'm no longer touring. I've got two small children, and
right.
I wanted something creative and something that was, you know, when I'm promoting it and when I'm doing it, I feel like I'm in a band. So I totally understand what you're saying.
Yeah. So like, I like that feeling, and I had met up with my buddy Joel, and we were doing something with their little studio, and I was like, man, that thing worked out really good. I was like, imagine if we did something that we cared about. It was like a country music video, like teen pop shit. I mean, they were really nice. I liked the people, but not the music and not what I want to be doing, you know, per se. I was very loved doing it when we were doing it, you know, but like, I was like, could you imagine if we were doing it with content that we like cared about, you know what I mean? If we did this much, just, you know, imagine if we had the passion for what the subject matter is and the passion for the technical side, you know? So I was like, and this is a time when like Netflix was having a lot of documentaries and like these punk documentaries, but it was always about like the violent punk era.
Yeah.
And I was
like American hardcore and all that stuff. Like, yeah.
Which is awesome. I'm not ragging on that, but it's not the punk rock that I grew up with. Like,
it's all the stuff that came before the stuff you and I grew up with.
Right. And the stuff we was a reaction to that. So it was not violent. It was it's like socially conscious. It was the opposite of nihilism. I call it neo hippie because it's like,
don't let Fat Mike hear that.
Well, he's a neo hippie.
I know.
In a lot of ways. He cares about the people around him. He you know what I mean? It's like this very like all the ideals of it, not the aesthetics, not the pretentiousness of hippies and like, but what it was kind of what it was before, when it was like being socially conscious and caring about and being a good person and your reputation was like one of the most important things, you know what I mean? So so I was like, why hasn't anyone done a Fat Records documentary? You know? I kind of
felt that same way when I saw yours was coming out. I'm like, I can't believe this has never been done before.
Right? It's like, I knew everyone I'd run into who loved Fat, like these people who love Fat Records who are still my same age, still loved it like a lot.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Because we had the record label that we were doing. So I would go to like Fest. We would always have a table and we would go, I did a table out at Punk Rock Bowling one year. And I just saw like people would bring their kids and I'm like, oh my gosh, like this like thing, like it's lasted for like 25 years.
Yeah.
You know? And so I was like, we should make a Fat Records documentary, but I didn't think that it would be what it was. Cause it was a thing to cut our teeth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The intention at the beginning was absolutely not to make a full length documentary. I had no idea that it was even possible to do something like that. You know what I mean? But like when I first shot the first things for the movie, I had no idea what like f-stop was, ISO, I had no idea what I was doing. Me and my wife went. I had a slider, but I had my buddy Joel. I was like, what should I rent? You know what I mean? Just tell me the best thing to rent. And I'll rent it. But you know, like there's, I'll say this because this could go on forever. By the way,
okay.
For movies to happen, like so many things have to happen in your favor. Like there are so many things, if it would have gone just one other way or if somebody would have said, so check this out. I had no connection to Fat Records. I had done that one thing with Joey Cape one time.
Yeah.
And so
Did you contact Joey about your idea, or did
not
you just...
Not at first, because the idea was to talk about people that had been influenced by Fat Records.
Oh, okay.
And it was going to be a short. It was just going to be a little short about, like, how we, like, how the people that we, around us... And then, you know, I had a little punk rock record label, so I knew a lot of local punk bands and stuff, like, you know, not local, but like lower level punk bands.
Yeah.
Like, that sounds diminutive, but I mean, like, not propaganda.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And so I lost my train of thought. bring me back on the rails.
So you weren't going to contact Joey right away. How did it all kind of come about?
Right. So I wasn't going to contact Joey because that wasn't the intention, but I was just going to go out and start shooting stuff. So I went out to Punk Rock Bowling and shot some stuff, and there's some other fun stories about that. But I came back and I cut together this little teaser. And the first crazy thing that happened was the company that I worked for as the marketing director, as soon as I got back, we had this showcase, and it's basically where all the kids, like, they rent out a place, like a stage, a big spot, and they bring in all these producers from around the country, like professional producers, to like rate them and judge this showcase, and potentially, hopefully, they can get deals out of it, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
But really they don't. But you know, it's a money thing, you know.
Potentially they could, but it's more about making money.
Yeah, it's gross, dude.
Yeah.
And I'm the person, like, that's in charge of, like, managing this thing. You know what I mean? Like, marketing it, like, help, you know, like scheduling it, like, doing the videos for it. Like, I am deeply involved in this production, right? And I'm so deeply involved, I don't notice that one of the producers' names is Ryan Green.
Okay, yeah.
I didn't even think about it until I got back. And I was like, I wonder if this is Ryan Green... And I look it up, and it's fucking Ryan Green.
I mean, yeah, and if you know Fat Records, you know Ryan Green.
I did not think it was that Ryan Green.
Yeah.
So my job essentially flew Ryan Green to me. Unintentionally, but when he showed up, I told him about the project, and he's like, yeah, I'll do an interview.
That's awesome, man.
And so at that point, I felt like I had someone in the inner circle.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, here's the guy who helped create the sound.
Yeah, you definitely. I mean, talking, you know, in the documentary, but we always knew growing up trying to record like Fat Records, you know, we'd take like a 50 cent piece or like a quarter and we'd duct tape it or box tape it to the kick drum so the beater would hit it. I always thought that was folklore. And then when I heard it in the documentary, I'm like, dude, we figured it out without even knowing.
That is so cool that you just told me that you thought that was folklore. And so in the movie... What did you think of the little visualization that we did for that?
Oh, I thought it was awesome. I mean, that's the one thing that, I mean...
That's Edgar Wright inspired.
We'll get into all that stuff. But yeah, everything that you guys did to kind of make the documentary move along and like connect everything and the different visuals, even like, I want to talk about the puppets later. But I mean, I think even if you're not a fan of the label or know nothing about it, the documentary is very enjoyable.
Thanks, man. That really means a lot to me, you know, like... I think my goal was to make a movie that I wanted to see as a Fat Records fan. I was like, if someone's making a documentary about Fat Records, they better make it good.
Yeah. Well, and I love the fact that you guys zeroed in on all of the main, like, first, you know, era bands. Like, you didn't, like, leave anybody out. I love the fact that there was just as much talk about Propaganda as there was Lagwagon or as there was No Use for a Name. Like, it was all there. It was.
I think the biggest criticism I get about the movie is that like I didn't include someone's favorite band. Yeah. And the reason there was first five are there, I got to finish to tell you how we got connected to the movie. But the reason the first five is because that's not only did Fat Mike and Aaron say that like multiple times in their interviews, but I thought that, and I had read interviews where he said like, the first five Fat bands really kind of established the sound. And these were all Ryan Green. You know, that was kind of like what established it. And then things kind of changed from there. So going back to what I was saying, I get Ryan Green, right? Right when I get back from Punk Rock Bowling, when I just shot the stuff. And by the way, Twitter, amazing tool.
Oh, dude, I use it for the podcast. And I've gotten some huge guests from Twitter and Instagram and say, as well. Yeah.
Hey, are you interested? You know, and Joe Sib was one of the first big names, you know, like somebody who had a, like, you know, from a, like, that had a big career.
Shout out to Joe, too. He's on tour with Metallica right now. I didn't know if you knew that. That's insane.
And he's going to be featured prominently in that No Use for a Name documentary.
Oh, that's crazy, man. Yeah, I'm going to try to get Joe on the show. I mean, if for nothing else, I want to talk about punk rock, but I want to talk about what it's like to be a comedian opening for Metallica.
Right? That's insane.
Yeah.
So we get that. I take the Brian Green interview, and I don't know if you've ever seen it. They're the first teaser is like... I actually kind of like. I did a bunch of motion graphic stuff, and it's not. It's like it's pretty. I mean, it's pretty good. Like,
yeah.
That's pretty good. When I went back and watched it the other day, and I was like, "This is pretty good." I mean, like, I used like a band from my record label on the thing, and a bunch of people were like, "Why did you do that?" It's because like when I put it on YouTube, I didn't want it to get taken down if I used a fat record song without permission.
Yeah,
that was happening. I put it up there with the, and I put at the bottom, like, you know, what it was. And I didn't want to use, you know, but I put that together and I was going to put it out. And I was like, I should really probably say something to Fat Records before I put this on the internet.
Yeah.
But I also didn't want to reach out to them and say, can I do a documentary? Because I had no experience at all. Like, at all. I had produced, like... I had shot maybe three or four music and edited three or four music videos, and we did that, produced that big music video and edited that thing. That was it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But the greatest, this is what I'm saying. For movies to happen, all these crazy things have to fall into place. So what had happened a few years earlier is that when me and Joey were exchanging emails, and by the way, I reached out to him on Facebook. I mean, not Facebook, MySpace. To come to our studio because you were doing a show in Dallas and Denton, which are very close together. So I was like, you can stay. We have a studio. You could come by. You can park the bus. And he did. He did. And so we were exchanging the mixes and stuff like that. You know, we exchanged emails. And so a year later, I get an email from about Lagwagon shows and playing guitar in Lagwagon, which was meant for a different Sean.
Okay.
He had accidentally put me in a email thread. But it had Fat Mike's email. It had a Chris Shiflett from the Foo Fighters email.
Wow!
Like all the Gimme Gimmes. Like it was like all the Lagwagon guys and all the Gimme Gimme guys. But even though I was in punk bands and I had a record label and all that stuff, I knew that was an abuse of that.
Yeah,
if that
definitely.
Makes sense.
Yeah,
I would not use that to promote my own thing. But when I was going to put this out, I remembered that I had Fat Mike's email. So I was like, this is a legitimate reason to reach out.
Yeah, you know I mean? He's not, even if he says no, he's not going to be mad that you
right,
said it.
That I emailed him.
Because you asked permission to do it, you know.
So I was like, hey, so I sent him this, like, hey, I'm putting this out tomorrow. And he sent back an email that says, looks cool. Which I took as like, in my ignorance... You know, the great thing about doing documentaries, you learn, you know, about how the ins and outs of everything. You get sometimes too close to the sun. But, like, I thought I was golden, you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot more, you know. But I'm saying if I wouldn't have been on that email thread, I don't know.
If any of this would have happened.
It would have played out the same way. Maybe if I put that out without talking to Mike first, he gets pissed off about it.
Yeah.
And is like, screw you, I'm not doing an interview with you. And then that movie doesn't happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
But after he did that, and after I put out the thing, it got a good response, and I got a lot of feedback, and it was really, the teaser was like, hey, if you like Fat Records, hey, we're looking for stories and, like, pictures and, you know, that kind of stuff. Because I also, once I thought I had Ryan Green, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, this is pretty, you know. So, like, and that's really how all the stuff happened. I mean, after that, like, after Mike gave me that looks cool, I put that out, and then NoFX was coming to Dallas in a couple months after that. So I hit him up, and I was like, hey, you liked it. Do you want to do an interview? You know? No response.
Yeah.
No response and I didn't want to kind of, like, poke the bear, you know? Like, I had already gotten a looks cool, so let me just, you know, chill for a while. But as I got closer, I hit him up one more time. I was like, hey, man, you know, you're going to be here, and I would feel remiss if I didn't at least ask one more time. You know what I mean? And he goes, email back, sure.
Just sure, no details or anything, right?
Nothing. Based on that, I go and I get cameras and I go to the, and I, like, I had a friend that worked the venue and we could kind of like hang out, like not in the, go into the show, but like kind of hang out near the back a little bit.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, we get there and I don't know who to talk to. I don't, like, you know what I'm saying? I guess. But I run into Ken. Kent.
Their manager, right?
Yeah. And he's like, so they tell me you're supposed to do some kind of interview or something. You know, and at this time, that could be just some, you know how they get all kind of interviews, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, who'd you talk to about this so-called interview? And I was like, Mike? He's like, He's like, He's like, all right. Well, he's sleeping right now, which he usually does until the show starts. And he's like, so I'll let him know. But, he's like basically like, tempering my expectations. You know?
He's like,
set your expectations. And I'm like, fuck that. I'm here until those buses roll out. And in fact, I'll stand in front of the bus holding the camera. They're like, you said yes. Because to me, that's like, it kind of goes back to what you were talking about. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he didn't have to say sure.
Yeah, he could have just not responded or said no way, but he said sure. Right. So I mean,
he said sure. So at some level, he agreed to it. So like, I felt like I could get him, like, but it was really dicey. Like, looking back, I had the coolest move, though. It was like, I mean, I want to toot my own horn here.
Toot away, man. Let me hear
so
about it.
So he comes in, and I'm like, hey, so documentary? He's like, yeah. He's like, I'm tired. I'm going to take a nap in the green room. And, he comes in, and he's kind of like, he goes into the green room and lays down. And so we're just kind of hanging around. And so I'm like, he's in there and the door's open, but we're really not supposed to go over there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I hadn't run into him yet. And so what I do is I kind of go down to the, right when the door is, and the way he's sleeping in a couch, he's like laying down on a couch, and the way the couch is facing, it faces right into the door. So you can see right out the door, right?
Yeah.
Like the line of sight. So what I do is I get in his line of, like, right in his line of sight, and, like, he opens his eyes and he locks eyes with me, and then I have the camera, like, and so I'm staring, like, we're locked eyes, right?
Yeah.
And I have the camera in my hand, and I slowly pull it into, kind of like those, like, slowly pull it into frame, essentially.
Okay.
Into purview. And he looks at me, and he does, like, that, like, you know, like, nonverbal, like, ah. I have people who can validate that this happened. Two people were watching when this happened. It was so awesome. I was like, pulled it into my field of view as well, you know what I mean? So it was like, camera, you know?
Camera?
Totally wordless. It was a totally wordless, like, thing. Like, hey, I'm here to do that fucking documentary. And he's like, all right, fuck it, we'll do it. So he's like, hey, can we do it after? And everyone I had talked to was like, don't do it after. No one ever wants to do an interview after. They're tired. They're fucking sweaty. No one does interviews after. If you don't get it before, he's probably not going to do it.
Yeah.
He did it. He fucking did it, man. It was great. And like, that stuff with El Jefe is really that's the first interview. The very first interview with Mike was that one with the El Jefes eating the cheese and shit.
Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, and like, once you have Mike, you have, like, for two reasons. One, you have the top guy, Records, Fat Mike. But also you have, like, someone who can say, like, dictate what's happening, if that makes sense. Like, this movie's happening. If Mike says it's happening, like if that makes sense, like, we're going to be doing filming at the Fat Records offices. I don't think everyone at Fat Records was as on board as Mike. Because, I mean, I look at it from their perspective. Who is this rando just coming and saying, making a movie about your thing that you've built for the last 25 years? And how do you know if they're going to tell it in a way that is good, honest, or, like, even, like, a moderately appealing? You know what I mean?
Was anybody at Fat involved in the process? I mean, like, no. Watching stuff you guys were doing or anything
nope.
like that?
Nope. Mike got a cut right before final.
Did he give his approval or did he just not say anything?
Oh, I got a
two word email.
No, he three paragraph email.
Wow, man, you that's a lot.
I'm getting like goosebumps just thinking about like that email. That's like probably one of the most validating emails I've ever had in my life. Cause it was like he literally said. Cause here's the thing, when we had met up a time before and he kind of like interviewed me, I guess, in his way to kind of see who I was and what my head was at and yeah. stuff. But like he was like, you can do it, man. It's cool. You know, you can use all the songs you want. You know, whatever you need, it's you got it. He's like, but it's gonna be boring, man. So make it short. It's gonna be boring. And I was like, I don't agree.
You know, the funny thing is, as you were doing that kind of in his voice, you sound a lot like Fat Mike saying that. It's almost like you have a good impression of him going.
Oh no, that sounds totally unintentional. Yeah. Like he said that, and I just totally disagreed because obviously, like, I mean, I just knew that people would be so revved up. How do you exist that long? I had existed in the music industry where, like, the school where I was the marketing director. It's where, like, Demi Lovato and Jessica Simpson, and they were a pipeline to those the talent shows. And, like, it's that kind of world. Like,
okay.
You know what I mean? Kids Bop, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, the way he operates his label is not how, like, it's done usually in the larger music industry. I think more so now. You know, I think that actually has changed quite a bit because I think the internet and like how you like that developing that relationship with your audience is so important now, which I think Fat Records was really good at, you know?
Yeah.
I honestly think their model is what, I mean, I don't think they established the model. I just think that particular model of having, you know, treating your, having a relationship with your fan base in a certain way, like, I think that's the way a lot of people are operating now. But it, like he, in the email, he said, I was wrong. You were right.
Wow.
He literally said, I was wrong. He's like, and I never say I'm wrong. He's like, most people, like, I didn't have the vision that you had on this. And that's rare for people to have, like, you know, if that makes sense. And so it was like,
yeah,
hugely validating. You know, validation only lasts like a split second, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Like I'm right back to self-deprecating and self-doubt, like within like 20 minutes. But which is, I think, is a level of that is always good to keep you humble. I think that's, you know. But in that moment, I was able to feel like I did it. And same thing with once Erin saw it, I got the same kind of compliment from her. She's like, that's not necessarily the movie I would have made, but that you really captured the vibe of the label and the feel of it, you know.
I mean, all of the dealings I've ever had with Fat Records over the years, I mean, it is like a family, and I know like on the documentary someone says it's more like a mafia, but it's like the handshake deals and just the way that everybody, there's no real competition between the bands. The bands all really want all the other bands to do well, and I think you captured that really well as well.
Yeah, and you know, it's that's the most satisfying thing as like someone who makes shit is when like people pick up on what you were trying to say. You know, there's this really like we didn't get a lot of like official reviews like from like the, you know, Hollywood Reporter, and like we didn't get a New York Times, you know, review or LA Times review. So, you know, so our Rotten Tomatoes doesn't have, you know, a thing on it. You know what I'm talking about? It doesn't have like a certified fresh. But there is one review on there, and the one review is like, makes me cry every time I read it. Like, and the guy was like, he's like, I wasn't even that into these bands, but now I want to go listen to all of them. Like,
that's awesome.
It was like, oh my gosh, this is like, it was that, like, if you ever have a chance, go check you know, I don't want to like talk about it too much, but go read it. And if you like the movie and you like, I know you got all of it, you know, this is someone who wasn't necessarily as close to the stuff as we were getting what the movie was about, you know, like,
yeah.
And, you know, also talk about the 8-bit stuff, all the little like gimmicks that we put in there to make it not boring.
Well, that's one thing I wanted to talk to you about. I wanted to talk about like the idea for the puppets and like how that all came about, because I think that added a really cool element to the film that, you know, there was a Fat Mike puppet. There was an Erin puppet. There was like There was a Chris Hanna puppet, you know?
So we had shot a lot of the movie already. And we actually did two crowdfunding runs. We did one was the main one that like blew the fuck up. And we didn't even talk about that. Yeah. That like, you know, we had a $7,500 goal for a short that we were going to make, hit that first 24 hours, raised $36,000 at the end of the game.
Wow.
Went back to try and get another 12, ended up with another 8. But the 8 was for puppets and animation. Like, that's really what that was for. Now, the way those came about, when we were shooting, the first crowdfunding thing had paid for the trips out to California to do the main, not like the main interview trips. And one of the bands that we were talking to was Bad Cop, Bad Cop, and we went down to San Diego to film them live. They were one of the newer bands that had been signed at the time. Yeah. And like, we want to show how like they were branching out and kind of show where the label was and have people that were current also in it, you know? And plus I just like, you know, we like them and stuff. Like, we had met them before and thought they were really cool. So when we went to the show out in San Diego, like after the show, Jenny Cotterill, one of the singers for Bad Cop, Bad Cop, she was like, and also an amazing artist, like visual artist. She does like all kind of different things, like shadow boxes, murals. She did design the mural, one of the murals for Parks and Recreation.
Oh, that's awesome.
She used to draw the backgrounds for Metalocalypse.
Jeez, so she's done some really cool stuff.
She's super talented, like amazing. And so I already knew all that. I didn't know about the Metalocalypse, but I knew she was an amazingly talented visual artist. And she, after the show, she was like, "Hey, I just want to throw something at you. I make puppets." And then she showed me some puppets she had made previously. And that was it. Like, I knew. Like at that moment, my head, like, you know, like, epiphany moment?
Yeah, totally, yeah.
I was like, I knew that it was, because we were batting around a few ideas, like, having some, like, doing some cutscenes with, like, having kids playing, like, Fat Mike. Nothing salacious, but, like, dressed up as punk rockers, you know?
Yeah.
Like, not drinking, not the drug stuff, but, like, you know, some of the ones where, like, it'd be, like, kids dressed up as Fat Mike acting out the stuff. Kind of like a la Drunk History.
But
so expensive, very complicated. Getting kids is very, that's, you know. And we have no fucking clue what we're doing at this point still, because first movie we've ever made. So, like, that's just beyond us, you know, organizing that properly. So when she said that, I was like, this is it, you know. This is, like, the way we can do it. And at the time, I didn't know how they were going to turn out. Because my philosophy, and I worked with a lot of amazingly talented people to make this movie, you know what I mean? Like, a lot of the motion graphics by Jeremy Fry. He's, like, an Emmy Award-winning motion graphic artist that now works for Xbox.
Wow.
Like, he is a great dude. He reached out to me and asked if he could work on the movie. Like, can I please work on this movie for free? I was like, yes. So, basically, my philosophy is people who are good at what they do, you just give them some parameters and you hire them to do what they do.
Yeah.
Like, so with Jenny, I was like, here are my parameters. Like, because it was going to be expensive to make all big puppets, you know what I mean? Because of how detailed those were.
Yeah.
So I came up with the idea, was like, let's make Mike and Aaron are going to be like the main puppets. But then if you can make me a second level of four puppets that have interchangeable heads, you know, that you can slap on different heads on. That way we have 8 different characters we can do without having to have, like, 8 puppets worth of work, right?
Yeah.
And to get it into the budget that we needed. So, and there's actually 12 sock puppets in the different versions of punk rock, like the Turbo Negro type people, you know, like all different kind of punk rockers, Mohawk guys. They just didn't read the way we hoped in the movie, so they only pop up in like 1 or 2 scenes. But she made 12 of those, 4 of the mid-level puppets, and then 2 of the ones with the bone structure. And, you know, she made puppets unlike any other puppets I've ever seen.
Do you still have the puppets? Like, are they prominently, like, in your house?
No, they're in bins.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, bins squirreled away.
Well, like, I saw some pictures of you guys like at a premiere or something, and you're like holding the fat mic bucket or whatever.
That turned out to be when we hit the non-punk rock world.
Yeah.
Did that make sense? We were doing like all the film festivals.
Yeah.
Like we would have like maybe one or two press signed up when we would get there that wanted to talk to us. Kind of how the red carpet works. When we bust out the puppets, flood of requests to talk to us.
There you go. Yeah.
Every single person wanted to talk to us. It really brought in a lot of, I've read also that some people like the puppets can turn them off, but I think more so it drew people in that were not into punk rock to kind of check out what we were talking about. And I had another very validating thing when you're making a movie, someone who has no idea about punk rock, doesn't even like that kind of music, comes to you and says, I don't even like this kind of music. But the story you told and like when they caught up the business ethics side and like the relationships between those people and like got what the movie was about beyond the punk rock, which for me is chosen family, punk rock business ethics is, you know, one of the biggest ones that I wanted to show. And like how you can operate in this world, be successful and treat people right. It's possible.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying Fat Records has never made a mistake and treated somebody maybe the wrong way at some point. But I mean, I would say that if it happened, it was a mistake because everyone I've met tends to be lean, whether or not they like me or not, tends to be good people, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So yeah, man, the puppets were huge for us. And I mean, it, like, the original logo was just that Fat Records logo. And after the puppets, we took the photos of those puppets and Photoshopped them. Like the logo for the Fat Records logo, the puppets are at equal level because, you know, they both played a hand in the success of the label. They're facing away from each other because they were divorced, but they are back to back because they're still together, you know, yeah. For Fat Records.
I love that there's so much meaning in the logo you guys did. That's great.
Oh, man. It kind of ties back to what we were talking about earlier, like with Propagandhi. Like, there's the punk rock layer, which is fun, and the music is really well done. So, like, the technical stuff is awesome. The music is fun and exciting. And the lyrics, you know, it's got, fuck the flag, and, you know, all the stuff. And so you're rebelling, and you're like, yeah. But then as you start diving in, it gets deeper and deeper, and, like, it, like, opens up, like, all these other things. And I've always felt like I'm a fan of The Simpsons and Arrested Development and those kind of things. I always feel like, especially with things when I like The Simpsons or shows like that, where you like as you get older, like you go and watch them and you get so many more references.
There's like Easter eggs for when you get older. Yeah.
Yeah. Or as you become more knowledgeable about things, like you realize the depth. And I feel like there's a when things have depth, even if the person's not sophisticated enough to pick up on all the layers of depth, I still feel like you have a sense that things have depth.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like, you can sense if something is done with love or if it's done with, like, for a paycheck. Like, if I can, like, go into Transformers for a second. Michael Bay's Transformers are soulless.
It's done for a paycheck. Yeah, I gotcha.
The new Bumblebee movie, I've seen it twice already. It's amazing. It's like, it has so much. You can tell that the guy that made it loved Transformers when he was a kid. And also, like, if you haven't had a chance to see it, the Bumblebee movie is excellent.
I need to see it, but I have two children under three, so it's going to be a while.
My daughter's four. I took her to the movie. She's seen it. She went with us. We went to the, I don't know if you have them, like, there. We have drive-in movie theaters in Dallas.
We have them during the summertime, yeah.
So we'll go. We took her to see it, and she loved it. She's asked about Bumblebee a couple times. But if you're a fan of the series,
yeah,
it's the movie, it's the Transformers movie that you always wanted. And the reason I'm talking about it is only because you can tell that the guy loved it. And in the interviews, this is the guy that did Kubo and the Two Strings, Paranorman, you know what I mean?
Okay,
Like, his whole thing has been stop motion. Like, the guy knows detail, and he also knows good storytelling, and he also cares about the characters. Like, he cares about, like, Optimus Prime and Bumblebee, and he knows what important things about them are what you don't change, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not just visually aesthetic things. It's the core part of the characters, and you have to understand. And I know Transformers is a commercial, but I'm saying if someone makes a Fat Records documentary and didn't grow up with it and didn't really kind of understand what that was all about, it would get, you could feel it, if that makes sense.
That's one thing I could tell by watching it. Like, I mean, and I'll tell you right away, I've, since it's been on Amazon Prime, which is something I want to kind of parlay into here in a second, I've watched it. I own it on iTunes. I bought it the day it came out, the way it was like available. But then I also, now that it's on Amazon Prime and I can get to it so easily on my smart TV, I've watched it probably 10 times.
What?
Yeah, I love it, and I love seeing, and I've used it a little bit for research. Like Sam King from Get Dead was on the show, so I wanted to hear the entire story of dosing Fat Mike, and so like I've watched it a lot to get ideas, and like some of the new bands, like I've talked to a couple of people from different new bands about being on the show, and it's actually been a nice tool for me to go back and kind of come up with ideas for guests. So I know that's kind of a weird thing, but it's really helped me out.
That's like, thank you, man, for saying that. That's like, I mean, the things that I love, I watch over and over again. You know what I mean? I like the movies that I like and I tend to like, I watch them over and over and over again. So like to hear that it's repeatable, it's something you can watch more than once, is like, that is something that we intended, because there's so many layers. You know that shot? There's a shot of it. You know who Jason Heller is?
Yeah.
That, you know that shot of Jason Heller? You know what that building behind him is?
I don't know.
It's where that propaganda riot happened, where the police had to be called in. It's the Fraternal Order or whatever, one of those.
I had no idea. That's awesome, man.
Yeah, like it's like we put it behind, like we filmed them in Denver. And we knew that was there, so we went and shot it in front of it. And, like, you see what I'm saying? Like, there's, like a lot of stuff. If you ever look at the poster, look at the rating on the poster. It says punk as fuck.
Yeah.
And in the tiny, tiny, you have to, like, really get close. It says, how can you even read this? It's so small. And then it says, like, get ready for a punk rock thing. Like, I'd have to read it to, like, but it's like, I mean, it's your first movie and it may be your only movie.
Yeah.
So we did everything we could possibly think of. And, I mean, I'm personally very satisfied with the way it turned out. I'm very satisfied with the reception it got. I haven't talked about, we're working on a couple, we have two other documentaries we've been working on for the last couple years. And so I've been so steeped in like trying to manage, we're finishing editing on one that actually it's a Wilhelm Scream is the subject. It's,
are you serious?
It's not about, it's not a Wilhelm Scream documentary.
Yeah.
But they're the subject. The documentary is about what does it take to be a modern day working class creative, and we like they're kind of the main subject. But it's about them at home, and we talk to like their parents and their kids, and we also talk to a couple other creatives to connect it as creativity, not about music or like a band. It's really more about support systems.
Yeah.
And so when like some at a mid level range, of you know doing art, like. Like you, it may not. To do it, you have to have lots of people supporting you in different ways.
Yeah.
And so this kind of shows that. And I think a lot of people are going to relate to all. I mean, we got so, and it's got a great twist. We're in editing right now on it. So, and we have been for a while. So
Trevor's going to be on the show here in the future. So I'll have to ask him a little bit about that.
Only a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit. I won't go crazy.
Like we haven't announced it like officially. We've been working on it for like almost 2 years now.
Yeah.
We lived with them for like a month essentially.
Wow, that's cool.
We went to Canada. We talked to like we went to their parents' places. We went to Detroit, Canada, like Boston, New Bedford, down to while we were filming their show in Brooklyn, we got a little bit of stuff there, and Propaganda was playing, and I ended up hanging out with Ira Glass at the Propaganda show.
That's weird. Like, is this real life?
Dude, here's something that'll totally fuck your head up. Tomorrow, I'm interviewing Ira Glass for my new documentary that I'm working on.
Can you give me any details on what the new one's about?
Yeah, it's about the podcast industry.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, hey, if you need any, you know, low-level guys, let me know.
No, we're this week we're with Radio Lab, Ira Glass, Jad from Radio Lab will be up at Pineapple Street Media.
Wow.
And, Jody Avergan from 538 and 30 for 30. This one's going to be, and we're right in the middle of all the crazy shit happening. Did you hear about that? Gimlet got bought for $200 million by Spotify, or it's going to be.
I did not hear that. I haven't seen that. That's crazy.
$100 million. Do you know that I'm sorry, I'm sidetracking.
But, no, it's fine. Tangents galore,
in
man.
In 2017, the entire ad revenue of the entire podcast industry was only $350 million.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And Gimlet just got purchased for $200 million. That represents, watch what's about to happen. Do you know what that means? Do you know what that means? That means now podcasting is a legitimately, like, not in our eyes. We know
yeah.
it has been. In people who invest in things are like, what? 10x? Because their first investment was only like $2 million.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I mean, podcasting, I tell people all the time because, I mean, you're going to be episode like 42 or 43. I can't remember what it is.
Oh, awesome.
And I've been doing it now for about a year, almost over a year. And I've been fairly successful. I've got some good sponsors and, you know, everything's covered. I'm not putting a lot of money into it anymore. Yeah. And I have a really good time doing it. I have really good numbers and the guests are saying yes more and more and more. But when I tell people that don't know about podcasts, they're like, well, what's a podcast? Like, it's kind of the wild, wild west. Like I think eventually, and I mean, what you're telling me right now, I had no idea that happened. Yeah, podcasting's the next thing, man. I mean,
and it's happening right now.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, literally right now, like, which is so great that while we were in the plane over here, that news dropped. So I landed in New York and that happened. And we're like talking to everyone. Like, I'd imagine, I'm hoping there's a pretty good chance we'll get to talk to people at Gimlet.
Yeah.
Because Ira Glass, like, yeah. you know, like, I'm going to ask him. So hopefully he can get me connected. And so, anyway.
But no, I love tangents, but I tell you what, man, I've had you on the phone for over an hour. I don't want to keep you all day. I know you're busy. And are you a Super Bowl guy? Are you going to watch the game tonight?
No.
I'm not a sports guy. I just figured I'd ask.
We have a lot of this week we are doing all these interviews and there are a lot of them jam packed. So tonight we'll be going to bed early and we're getting right now I'm in a bunch of gear we've been planning out like our routes through New York to make sure we have enough time to get to everywhere, and we're checking all the equipment twice. And
yeah,
I mean, this is, I mean, for us is, you know, it's really weird, man. I say here's my advice to people. Here's my advice: if you want to hang out with your heroes, make a documentary about them.
Yeah. Is that the end of the advice? I felt there was like a butt coming up there.
No, that's it. I mean, I started this podcasting thing. You know Roman Mars from 99% Invisible?
Yeah, I think so.
Roman did the pull quote on the back of our Blu-ray because he turns out he's a punk rock guy. And I figured that out by listening to a bunch of his episodes. So I reached out to him and I sent him the movie and he sent me back this really thoughtful email, like, message. And then we were needing pull quotes. I was like, can I use some of your message from pull quote? And then about a year ago, we were working on a documentary, and one of the guys was a podcaster, because we're talking to podcasters, one of the people's a podcaster. And he goes, why aren't you making a documentary? Why don't you make a documentary about podcasts? And I was like, I should make a documentary about podcasts. And like, because we both know Roman. So I was like, I reached out to Roman, and I was only going to have it in my back pocket for when I finished with this new movie that we're working on. It's going to be called Lifer.
Okay.
Like, when he said that, I was like, oh, shit. So I reached out to Roman, and I said, hey, if I were to make a podcast documentary, would you be in it? And so he said yes. And so, like, I had that in my pocket. And then There's a whole other story involved with that. We'd save that for another day. But
we'll have a part two. I'll have you back. We'll talk about it.
Oh, that'd be cool, man. I told you I can talk, man.
I mean, I love it. I love all the stories. I just, you know, I like to keep these things around an hour. So we can have you back for a part two.
Yeah, man, it's cool, man. I fucking had a blast, dude. I'm really honored that you had me on. I'm a big fan of the music you made. So it's really, really cool to like, I don't know, man. It's like, it's all full circle. It's like the world we live in is like so crazy.
Yeah. So where can people, I know people can watch now on Amazon Prime, and I've been, even when I'm not watching, I've gone to bed before and let it play because I know you get paid if it plays. So
do you see our little video that we put out?
I did see the little video. Actually, that's how I connected with you on Facebook, because that came up in a feed somewhere on Facebook, and then I saw your name and I was like, oh, that's the guy that directed it. So that's, yeah, that kind of hooked us up, and that's why you're on the show.
Wow, that's totally rad.
I don't know if it was like hashtagging or metadata or whatever, but I saw it on my thing, and yeah, I got you on the show. So
that's very, very tangible result.
Is that how it happens, though? Like, the more that it plays, you guys get a little bit from that?
Yeah, like, so it would have been a few years ago, about 2 years ago, when the movie came out, we didn't think we were going to get streaming, to be honest with you, because it had come out and kind of played out, you know. What I thought was the movie, not done, but, you know, I thought it was, like, at its tail end. And then one day I was looking, and all of a sudden I saw it, I discovered it on Amazon.
Oh, yeah?
And I was like, we're on Prime? Wasn't I supposed to get money? Because normally when you do a deal with a streaming service, in the past they'd give you a big chunk of money for a specific period of time. You know, they'd say for this amount of time, we're going to give you X amount of money. With this, when I called my distributor, I'm like, am I supposed to get money or anything for this? Because, you know, it's Amazon. And they're like, oh, no, they have a new thing where they put it in and they do an algorithm, and then they pay you based on streams. And, you know, that's how Spotify and all that stuff works. And I'm like, you know, I know how Netflix works. So if someone watches, like, Filmage or any of those other great, you know, punk documentaries that are on Amazon. But I also decided I also wanted to give it a little boost.
Yeah, yeah.
But the other cool thing about that Amazon thing is now we're worldwide.
Wow.
So before, because of that, we're worldwide, but only places where we had translations. So a few months ago, I had everything translated for Germany. And German, like, dude, it blew up over there. Like, I mean, just recently. Like, it did really well. Like, the response I got, like, and so, like, we're now moving. The Spanish translations that we had were done by a friend, you know, kind of thing. So we could, when we did our screenings in those countries, we did over like 70 screenings worldwide that wow. I basically booked at like little indie theaters, like little venues and like, you know, kind of things like that. So we had other translations, but they have to be to a certain spec.
Okay.
For like Amazon and Netflix and shit like that. And it's cost about $1,000 to have it done. So at the end of Fat Wreck, we were pretty kind of like, I got advances on my for the distribution deal we got, but yeah. Every single bit of it went right back into the expenses that it takes for distribution. It's a massive expense, you know. Like the movie was like, you know, we got $40,000 from Indiegogo, right? If it was crowdfunding.
Yeah.
Yeah, the movie's about $100,000. You know, after all is said and done, you know what I mean? And yeah. Like, I'm still making payments on the movie, technically.
Well, maybe it'll blow up bigger, man.
Well,
maybe, you know,
because of the streaming now, I think we're very close to being able to have broken even. Like as far as the expenses and things like that, a lot of it was put on credit cards and, you know, everyone thinks that we got that money from the crowdfunding and like, oh, that was so much money. Like, yeah, well, they take 18%, you know, not 9%. You know, so you cut it down there, and you got to pay taxes because it's considered taxable income.
Yeah.
You know, like, so you have to, like, manage that. And so, like, when you get down to it, it's around 25, maybe 27,000, you know. So, like, indie movies are tough.
Yeah.
But they also have a long tail. So, like, the movie exists in the world now forever. Or,
yeah.
You know, into perpetuity, you know what I mean? It's not like, so now, and there's a lot of Fat Records fans that are going to have a chance to see it. So it's not, you know, eventually, once we recoup, we just basically split everything with Fat, you know.
Oh, so, that's cool.
That's why they gave us all the music. Like, all those Fat Records, like, they gave us, all, like, I don't know if you know how licensing works.
Yeah, a little bit.
But they gave us, like, we didn't have to, like, they gave us all of the not mechanical, the, I'm forgetting this shit, the recordings. But then you have the publishing you have to get as well. So we had permission for the recordings and all NoFX songs and the recordings that they owned, you know, the publishing to, which is a massive thing for NoFX to give us their songs.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
That is, you know, as an artist, you can charge as much as you want, little you want, say yes or no, and take as long as you want to say yes. Like, it's, everything's in their court. So there's 120 songs in the movie.
Jeez, yeah.
Like, if it wasn't punk rock, there's just no way we'd convince.
There's no way that it would work.
It just wouldn't have worked.
People out there that don't understand, I mean, if you watch, like, the Jimmy Fallon show or something, and they'll start to play a song, and then they'll stop, or they'll change it because they don't want to have to pay for it. So, yeah, if you use a song in your movie or a TV show, you've got to pay somebody.
We actually, like, the Ramones, we had a Ramones cover in there that we had recorded to, like, reference, right? Like, because, like, Fat Mike talks about the Ramones, as we had it behind it for a second. And they were like, $2,000. And that is, no, that's nothing.
I mean, yeah, that's nothing, but that's still, like...
For Beat on the Brat, that was like, holy, it's usually like $20,000 and shit like that. And I was like, nope. Like, it was like not worth it. But anyway, I'll keep going, man.
Well, hey, man, I just want to say thank you very much for being on the show today. And you've told us you've got some new movies coming out, so we're looking forward to that. Where can people find you on the internet? Anything you want to promote, like socials or anything?
Yeah. Like, obviously, like, everything for the movie is A Fat Wreck. Like, if you type that in to Google, you will get the movie, because Fat Records website is fatwreck.com and our website is afatwreck.com.
Yeah.
So, and that has all our social stuff on there. Everything's A Fat Wreck.
Okay.
The film company, like, our production company is Open Ended Films. And that's, we're on Instagram and Twitter, and it's basically me. You know what I mean? Those are my things. But I tend to not post a whole lot until we're, like, in production. You know what I mean?
Okay.
So, like, this week, if anyone's listening, during I don't know when you post this. I know how podcasting
this
works.
This
so.
Will be out in a couple weeks, actually.
So by the time you hear this, last week or so, we were filming. And so you'll see, if you go on our social media right now, you'll probably see a lot of shots from us, the movie working on right now. And if you go on the Fat Records, Fat Wreck Instagram, there, it goes back to, like, when we first started the movie, and you can kind of see, we took pictures, like, the puppets when we did stuff and all the screenings and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Awesome,
that's
man.
A Fat Wreck and Open-Ended Films.
Cool. Well, Sean, thank you so much. And I definitely want to have you back for a part two, because I enjoy all the stories and I want to hear the rest of them. So.
Fuck yeah, man. I'd be honored.
Awesome, man. Well, I want you to have a great night. Keep up the good work, and I will talk to you in the future. Okay.
All right. Later.
Thanks a lot. Later. So there it was, my conversation with Mr. Sean Colone of Open Ended Films and the director of one of my favorite documentaries, A Fat Wreck. You guys need to check it out. It is streaming currently on Amazon Prime for free if you are a Prime member. You can also get it on iTunes or wherever you get your movies. Check it out, A Fat Wreck. It's a punkumentary, as it says. I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to cut this short. I'm very tired. I'm going to go to sleep. Thank you guys for listening. I appreciate all the support. Every week we are growing and growing, and we keep charting. We've charted now 10 weeks in a row on iTunes. So make sure you're going over there and subscribing, rating, and reviewing. That helps the show grow. I would really appreciate that. Also, check out the Patreon, patreon.com/TOTOT podcast. We could use the support over at Patreon as well, and there'll be all kinds of cool exclusive content for our patrons. So I'm going to get out of here, and I'm going to leave you guys with two songs by two of my favorite Fat Records bands. The first song is going to be Island of Shame by Lagwagon. It's like on their first record way back in the day, so the beginning of the record label. And then I'm going to take you guys up to Propagandi from like 2005. It's a speculative fiction. So it kind of shows you, you know, how it started and where it came. And I mean, you know, I would play something from now, but it's already over an hour and a half. So I'm going to play two songs because I cannot not play a Lagwagon and a Propagandhi song. So thank you guys once again. I'll see you next week. My guest is going to be Chris number two from Anti-Flag. I can't wait for that. You guys are really going to enjoy it. So enjoy this Lagwagon song and this Propagandhi song, and I will see you next week. Make sure to listen to the end for the hidden track. I'll see you guys. Thanks a lot.
I'm that 6 foot cubits and a spare. A shepherd's sling and five stones in her hand. The battle of 1812 lives in our hearts.
Chris, I'm still here. I got to tell you about this hidden track. I think it deserved a little explanation. Today is the 13th of February. It is Mr. Henry Rollins' birthday. So shout out to Hank. Happy birthday, Hank. This is a public service announcement that Henry did against doing meth. I thought it was pretty cool. And I'm against meth, so I'm going to play it. Here it is.
You might take meth because of how it feels. But this is how it feels to your heart. The only difference is, you can't rebuild a heart.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.